Which of the parables of physical is in the eye of the beholder? I think it's the. Okay, so the title that Leon gave me was Deconfined Quantum Criticality. And really, I think one should put the deconfined in quotes, and I'll hopefully explain that as the talk goes on. So this is some work that was really started about a year ago by some beautiful ideas and work by Lasik Mochernich and Ashwin Vishwana, who are both here. And I'll tell you about what they did as we go on. But basically, you know, following up on their idea and in collaboration with them, some of the you know, more senior people stepped in, you know, trying to elbow in and get a little bit of credit, you know. So Sento, Leon, I think we can go first name, Subir, and myself. Okay, so basically, by way of motivation, let me recollect the, you know, renormalization group breakthroughs of the early 1970s, which gave us a way to not only think about it, but to calculate properties of classical continuous phase transitions. I don't know, many in the audience are probably not old enough to remember this or weren't born. I'm not old enough to remember it as a physicist, but I remember it as a member of a household. So, as you know, essentially what the breakthrough really, in some sense, was Wilson taking Landau theory, and Landau theory starts with a free energy in terms of an order parameter, which is non-zero in one phase and zero in the other. And what Wilson did is basically interpreted the free energy, or the free energy density, as an effective field theory. So he was working then with an effective classical free energy density in the quantum case, when it's essentially working with the Lagrangian density. Okay, so quantum phase transitions, people, you know, started thinking about them almost immediately in the 1970s. And I think many people have felt over the years that quantum mechanics is only worth one dimension. And that when you have a quantum phase transition, a phase transition at zero temperatures, you tune some parameter in your model, that one can really understand that by focusing on an effective classical system mechanical problem in d spatial dimensions plus the one time dimension. And in fact, I remember this well from the early 1980s when my father wrote an article for the 100th anniversary of Bohr's birth, I guess. And the title was, you know, Why Quantum Mechanics is Irrelevant in Condensed Matter Physics. Okay, it's only worth an extra dimension.
Matt, I thought the title was How Relevant is Quantum Mechanics?
Was it? Okay. I prefer the title I just gave you anyway. But, so.
And the answer was about 50%. Michael Feinstein was about 50%.
No, I mean, the article was actually pretty interesting and with a lot of interesting points. This was right as the fractional quantum Hall effect was, you know, had been discovered and was starting to become of interest. And I was just in the middle of graduate school. And so, you know, I decided at that time that I would try to rebel and look for phenomena, quantum phenomena, which you really cannot understand in any classical variables, right, where there's, you know, they're intrinsically quantum mechanical. And the fractional quantum Hall effect is one perfect example. There's no set of variables, really, in which it behaves like an effective classical model. And the reason that quantum phase transitions can be significantly more interesting and complicated than classical phase transitions in one.
I didn't understand your statement. Fractional quantum Hall effect doesn't have any phase transition.
Yeah, it does. Sure. I mean, take the transition between different plateaus, or even quantum phases. Okay, maybe that wasn't a good example. But I mean, the article didn't just say quantum phase transitions can be thought about with one extra dimension. All quantum mechanics can be viewed as just classical physics, not just a phase transition. We can understand quantum mechanics with one extra dimension. Now, he admitted fermions, are problematic, but free fermions is all we ever do anyway. So we put that aside, and everything else is classical system mechanics, including, the quantum phases, and, largely, for many of them, that's actually true. Well, okay, I'll tell you. So basically, a quantum system which is intrinsically quantum mechanical, I mean, it's not really a sharp definition, but roughly speaking, the Lagrangian is going to be in imaginary time, in Euclidean time, the Lagrangian is going to have imaginary terms. It's not a real weight, right, in the partition function, in the quantum partition function. What often one has is sort of Berry's phase terms, which make the effective action imaginary. And ultimately, when you try to track down the source of these Berry's phase terms, they are really in condensed matter systems coming from the fact that the electron has a quantized charge and a quantized spin. Right. So it really is inherently quantum mechanical in that sense. Okay, so what I want to tell you about then is this work.
Really mean in the sense that quantum mechanical systems can't be reduced to physical mechanics.
Yeah. Well, I mean that's okay, but it's a little tricky because in one set of variables you may have, the Lagrangian may be complex, but if you do a dual transformation to a new set of variables, it can be, and sometimes it can end up being real. There are situations, certainly situations we have where we don't know of such a set of variables in which it becomes real. It's a little more subtle. That's why I don't want to make a sharp distinction. I think what we'll try to see is that these deconfined quantum critical points are it's not just the presence of an imaginary term which makes them differ. They're different in a rather interesting and qualitative way. Okay, so in particular, what we have realized over this last year is that quantum phase transitions can violate this Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson, let me call it paradigm. That is a paradigm where one focuses on the order parameters in the phases, on one of the phases nearby the transition, and writes down an effective field theory for that order parameter. And moreover, what we realize is that some quantum phase transitions can be between phases in which Landau would predict, Landau theory and Wilsonian theory, if you will, would be forbidden. Okay, and in particular, as I'll show you momentarily, it's what I'm talking about here are when there's a transition between two phases which have different order parameters, and as we will see, you can have a direct quantum phase transition between two phases where right at the transition you lose one order and you get the other.
Continuous,
yeah. We see that these quantum phase transitions can have an emergent topological structure right at criticality, right at the continuous quantum phase transition, even though this topological structure is not present in either phase, on either side of the phase transition. We see that such deconfined quantum phase transitions, which fall into this class, are expected to have two divergent length scales, or at least the ones we've been exploring do. I'm not sure it's absolutely necessary. In addition to the correlation length, there's another length, we call it psi prime, which diverges as a power of the correlation length with a power bigger than 1, so it diverges more rapidly. The other thing that comes out is that such deconfined quantum phase transitions.
That means two different exponents then?
Yeah.
Two independent.
Yeah.
Are they connected by hyperscaling?
No. I mean, this actually can happen in classical phase transitions as well. But the dangers of the relevant operators, not, you know, well, we'll see if I actually get to it. But
when you have two phases which have different order parameters, can it be that these directions are different relevant to the equation?
Well, let me defer that question. And yeah, I mean, these quantum Degenfang quantum critical points are only going to have one relevant direction. You only have to tune one parameter to reach them. I mean, that's so that they're not multi-critical. I know this exactly. Landau would say, in order to have a direct trans, I might suggest that, but it's not the case. You only have to tune one parameter to get to these phase transitions. Okay, so we realize that a natural description is in terms of fractionalized fields. So let me just schematically write that the order parameter is written as a product of two other fields, psi1 and psi2. And psi1 and psi2 play, you know, are much more natural variables to be using. And basically, because of this, the anomalous dimension of the order parameter at these phase transitions, which basically tells you how hard it is to, you know, how incoherent propagating the psi particle is at the phase transition, the anomalous dimensions are much larger, typically, than they would be at a conventional Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson phase transition. The reason is because when you add in the order parameter particle, if you will, it splinters into two, and both of those are, you know, strongly interacting, and they don't move as free particles. But so it's much one expects a much broader spectral function for the order parameter than one typically would have. Okay, so that's the introduction. What I want to do now is just focus on one particular quantum phase transition, which we've looked at in quite some detail, a phase transition for a two-dimensional square lattice spin 1/2 Heisenberg antiferromagnet, a transition going from the antiferromagnetically ordered phase to a valence bond solid phase. Anyway, then I'll talk about the importance of hedgehogs, topological defects in the theory, give you a reason why gauge theories naturally emerge here. I should say that these fractionalized fields are carry a gauge charge of an emergent gauge theory. Then I will, if time, which I probably won't have, I mean, talk a little bit about duality and monopoles in that gauge theory. Okay. Okay, so AF to VBS. Okay, so as I say, we've got a square lattice, spin 1/2, spins on a square lattice, Hamiltonian, we consider, is just the nearest neighbor antiferromagnetic exchange interaction. We want to complicate the model a little bit more. So what we do is we're going to add a four-electron ring exchange process where we sum over four-site plaquettes, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, what this script P refers to is an operator which takes basically the four electrons whose spin 1/2 we're considering and rotates them clockwise or counterclockwise by 90 degrees. Okay, and in terms of the spin operators, 1, 2, 3, 4, it looks rather nasty, and I'm not going to write out the full. It's a whole bunch of terms. The main thing is it's quartic in the spins. Okay, and let me define a parameter, a dimensionless coupling, if you will, which is the ratio of this ring exchange divided by the nearest neighbor antiferromagnetic exchange interaction. And now let me discuss the phase diagram as a function of G, you know, running from 0 up to large values. Take it positive. Okay, well, we know when g is equal to 0, and presumably when g is very small, that the phase we're going to be in is just a conventional antiferromagnetic phase. I mean, this we didn't know in 1987, right after the discovery of ITC, but we now know, you know, because basically there's no sign problem, and there's been a lot of beautiful work on, in essentially, you know, solving exactly, almost, I mean, this model. So the question is, what happens when g gets large? Well, we don't entirely know what happens when g gets large, but we have some insight from, in fact, an easy plane version of this model, where one takes the spin operators and basically just, well, it's not that one drops the z component. I mean, I should say, it's really one takes an anisotropic coupling in the xy plane, j perp, and a coupling jz in the along the z axis in spin space. And if one drops the jz coupling altogether, then beautiful numerical work by Anders Sandvik, Anders is somewhere here, and Doug Scalapino and Roger Melko, who's a graduate student here, finds that they get a phase out at large value of g, which is called a valence bond solid, and that phase, okay, what that phase looks like is two spins on nearest neighbor bonds form a singlet. Okay, so which is up, down, minus down, up, 1 over square root of 2. I mean, that's a valence bond.
So this is just a singlet solid?
No, it's a singlet solid. Yeah, so it's going to be a singlet solid. So, or a single solid or a single crystal. So let me, if there's a singlet bond formed, I'm just going to shade it in like this. Okay, and the phase that actually the system goes into is essentially this crystalline phase. I mean, the key point here is that since each site has one electron, a spin a half, it can only form a singlet with one of its neighbors. And so it's a hard time forming singlets with all of its neighbors at once. And so what the system decides to do is, you know, decides which neighbor to pick, spontaneously breaking then the rotational and translational, you know, discrete translational and rotational symmetries of the lattice. And in fact, there's a fourfold degeneracy. There's a fourfold degeneracy in the ground state.
Your historical setting is more like the J1, J2 model, right?
I don't care.
Yeah.
Maybe it is, yeah.
Yeah,
you know, you take your favorite model that has an antiferromagnet, you put in any couplings you want. Okay, you take your favorite model, which is an antiferromagnet there, which you believe has a valence bond solid phase over here. And what we're going to be focusing on is whether you can have a direct transition.
Matthew,
yeah.
This state, is it not the state
of
the second
term? No. Yeah.
So putting J squared infinity does not give you that state.
You know, it doesn't. In fact, There's another phase out here, a larger value of g in the xy case.
Is Hamiltonian at all? Is it
eigenstate? No, I mean, these two terms compete against one another. I mean, you can't simultaneously. We don't know.
Is it eigenstate?
No, none of.
Not of
course not.
The argument that this is the ground state is numerical.
Yeah, I mean, It's numerical. It's Monte Carlo, quantum Monte Carlo. The point is, the reason we can't normally do quantum Monte Carlo on models like this is because they have a sign problem, and it's just a killer. But in this easy plane limit, there's no sign problem. And so one can, you know. Yeah, so it's basically you replace S1 dot S2 by S1 plus S2 minus plus emission conjugate, i.e., you know, S1x, S2x plus S1y, S2y. Okay, I mean, it's that replacement. And I replace that in every term here. That's basically. You know, and it's a rather embarrassment in the field, but basically, this model that in this easy plane limit was the first example of a model which, where we could establish the presence of the valence bond solid phase. I mean, I think it's the only one that exists at this stage.
Easy plane limit also has a
Yeah, it does. It is an easy plane antiferromagnetic phase, and it appears to have a direct phase transition between the two.
Is it a lot to ask what the evidence is, since you said it's numerical? I mean, this seems very crucial, right? Having this phase transition. This is like universally accepted, everybody agrees there is this phase transition?
I think basically Anders had the numerics, they were doing this before, these theoretical ideas, and they were finding what looked like a direct continuous phase transition. Correct me if I'm wrong, Anders. What's the nearby state? Well, the antiferromagnet can be a nearby state.
Can you make this lines disorder?
Well, one way you're doing that is, sure, they disorder when you go over to here. You could probably have a transition from the valence bond solid into an RVB liquid as well.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to be talking about that. Yeah. The reason I wrote down this Hamiltonian was just, as really by way of motivation. But, I mean, I think as Leon is emphasizing one, in these models, which are sufficiently complicated that, 9/10 of them, we just don't have a prayer of understanding their behavior quantitatively using any numerical techniques. One is often forced to just do, essentially phenomenology, guess the form of various phases that can exist, look for local stability, and then ask whether you can have phase transition between them, for example. I mean, that's...
You said there's numerical evidence for continuous phase transition.
There is in this easy plane limit, but
the question is, what is continuous? There isn't a given 1,000 order, a single order parameter. So what is it that's continuous?
Well, I mean, actually, presumably both order parameters, go to zero on either side continuously, and there's diverging lengths associated with each of those on the disordered side. But I don't actually want to get into the numerics of some. I mean, there's a challenge. We'll have to have him give a talk, exactly. So let me very quickly talk about the Landau forbidden nature of this. Okay, so I'm going to follow LGW and write down order parameters. Okay? And so the one is a nail order parameter. It measures a staggered spin on this square lattice, and in the antiferromagnet, it's non-zero, and it's zero in the, it's zero in the quantum paramagnet. Okay, let me not presume for the moment, what phase is going to be on this side. I'm coming from the antiferromagnet, I have long-range order, I've got a broken symmetry, and on the other side, it's a quantum paramagnet, which doesn't have magnetic order. Some other phase over there. And basically, maybe what I'll do is also I'll write down the one for the valence bond solid. So this is a three-component a vector which we can take it have unit length. It's not that important. In fact, what is maybe more convenient for Landau theory is to replace this by a three-component real vector which has components x, y, and z, and it has soft spin, is not constrained to have a unit length. And in the quantum case, we're going to want to include, the propagation in imaginary time. Okay. So Wilson would build a theory in terms of this field capital phi, and the theory that one would write down is a theory which respects the symmetries of the underlying model, and which mostly is spin rotational invariance and the various discrete lattice symmetries. And so the natural theory to write down is just basically a 5/4 field theory, right? So I will write it very quickly, but d tau phi squared plus r phi squared plus u phi to the fourth great and okay and the action of course is you know d2r d tau of this Lagrangian density in the usual way and okay so and the two phases are you know r less than zero is the anti-Fermat magnet one breaks the symmetry r greater than zero is the quantum paramagnet within mean field theory of course one can do fluctuations and a Fermat epsilon expansion blah 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 where this order parameter is zero okay you know hopefully reasonably familiar to many of you let me do the same thing for the valence bond solid I can do it here So the valence bond solid, let me introduce a complex order parameter, a complex field psi. Okay, and let me define it this way. Okay, as a measure of the strength of the you know the strength of the effect of the spin-spin interaction across bonds in the x direction, and we want to modulate it with period two, and okay, it's going to be non-zero when the real part of psi is non-zero, and the rotated and the real part of psi can take on two well okay and the rotated guys are going to be proportional to the imaginary part of psi. And so the field theory that one would write down, the quantum, you know, Landau, Ginzburg, Wilson, a field theory would be L VBS equals DT psi mod squared, you know, grad psi mod squared. Oh, I need the grad. Yeah, okay, whatever. There's a spatial gradient here. And then plus, let me write r prime mod squared plus u prime mod psi to the fourth. Okay. Well, now, I mean, let's try to apply these field theories to this transition or a putative transition. Let me look at the anti-ferromagnet going into some quantum paramagnet. What anisotropy? Well, it's a cubic symmetry, so a square symmetry, so it's not there. You're right. Oh, but actually, let me add a term which I should have added, and this is important. Oops. Sorry. Use a blackboard space, not doing very well here. Okay, so this term is important because it selects, I mean, without this term you have a global U1 symmetry, but we really want four discrete states, like, you know, Z4 or maybe it's a, I don't know what it's called. Is it called Z4? Yeah, Z4 symmetry. And so if one puts this term in, when psi picks up an expectation value, this term with V4 positive will select out four possibilities. The real part psi is positive or negative, and the imaginary part of psi is positive or negative, corresponding to these four states. Okay. Okay, but now let me... try to approach the phase transition and try to describe the phase transition with LGW approach. I'm really slowly here, but I don't know. Here we are. At least people will understand more or less what I'm doing.
So this last term that you worked on must be partial somehow, right?
It doesn't what?
This this last term that you wrote down must be crucial somehow.
That's what it's crucial. Yeah. It's going to be crucial, and actually, okay, you can still see it. In the end of the day, it is going to be even more crucial than you can guess at this stage.
Can you motivate that one more time? Either I fell asleep or I didn't understand.
Oh, okay, so I have four states here in the valence bond solid. You know, the two column states, and then the two row states. And I want to, if I didn't have this term here, I'd have a continuous U1 symmetry, which is basically essentially the symmetry under rotations. But I want to pick out four. Yeah, exactly. I think that's.
And this is the minimal thing that does that, I guess.
Yeah.
You need to just show it by symmetry.
Yeah, no, in fact, under rotations by 90 degrees. Thanks, Leon.
It's just 90 degrees.
Psi goes to I psi.
Z2 times
Z2. I'm fine. It's Z2 times Z2. Yeah. I don't know any group theory, Duncan, so that's... I never learned it, and I still don't know it. And I'll probably end up dying not knowing it, so...
That is essentially a clock model.
I don't know. It's whatever you want to call it. It's the model right there.
Clock model of four?
I don't know. What?
Yeah, this is more state clock model.
Okay, good. I don't know the names of things, and the so...
Anyway, basically you need to distinguish, you need to keep just these two distinctions, and that just does that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the real part of psi is has to do with correlations along the x direction and the imaginary y direction, and the square lattice has its orbital rotational symmetry. So.
I mean, the complex psi plane, imaginary psi, real psi, you know, I guess for this, well, okay.
You don't even have to talk about the ground state. You just talk about the
Zeidler question also.
I mean, this term's allowed by symmetry under fourfold 90 degree rotations, and so you have to include it. Now, yeah. Without it, the model it has a higher symmetry than the original, artificially higher symmetry than the lattice that you started with. Okay, so let me try to describe the transition coming from the antiferromagnet. And I'll go back. Okay, so we have the antiferromagnet. Quantum paramagnet G. Okay, so let me use the field theory. I mean, this 5/4 vector field theory, and look at the properties of the phases. I mean, I've already said what they are. R less than zero, phi is non-zero, and that's the antiferromagnet. That's completely, simple. Let's look though at the quantum paramagnet, where the mass term is positive, excitational value of phi vanishes, and let's look at the spectrum of quantum excitations in the quantum paramagnet. And to do that, I'm going to drop the U term. And basically, I just have a Gaussian theory. And what I see is that the spectrum has a triplet of excitations with dispersion square root of R plus K squared. And there's three of them. But the most important thing is that when R is positive, there's a unique ground state. Right? In this field, there is a unique ground state. When R is positive, drop the U. And that's a problem. How can we possibly go over to a valence bond solid phase which doesn't have a unique ground state? Well, in fact, okay, so maybe we're not going to the valence bond solid phase. I've just set down a field theory for the antiferromagnet. Maybe I'm going into, quantum paramagnet that doesn't break translational symmetry, which has a unique ground state. Okay, but those of us that were, I guess, in the talk, when was it, a couple days ago, who've thought about Lieb-Schultz-Mattis-type theorems and what Matthew Hastings has been doing recently, basically, there's essentially a consensus, if not a rigorous result, that if you have a two-dimensional system on a torus with one electron per unit cell, that in the limit that Lx and Ly go to infinity, if you don't have any broken translational symmetry, that you necessarily have to have an excitation energy above the ground state, which goes to zero. Am I getting this right? Okay, I think it's more or less right. Okay, and so one way to do that, as we now realize, is to have topological order. You know, an RVB or Z2 spin liquid, which has a gap, but on the torus it has fourfold degeneracy. So there are, it's not a unique ground state, there are four states, all with the same energy. So that's okay with this, you know, theorem, let me call it. Okay, but we're actually not interested here in such exotic phases. We're interested in a more conventional looking phase, the valence bond solid. Okay, so we really want to break, you know, we want to break translational symmetry. And we want a degenerate ground state with, if we're trying to go into this valence bond solid phase with fourfold symmetry breaking. I should incidentally say that this field theory is kind of nonsense in the context of this quantum model, because it describes when R is positive, a quantum paramagnet with no broken symmetries and unique ground state. So it clearly cannot be relevant to any transition from a quantum nail state into a quantum paramagnetic state on a square lattice, I mean, with one spin and a half. So it's basically, you know, kind of nonsense.
Say it again, why
again? Well, okay, so this theory has, in its quantum paramagnetic state when R is positive, is a unique ground state. I mean, there's basically a theorem which says that when you have one electron per unit cell, and you're on a torus and the thermodynamic limit, that you can't have a unique ground state with a gap. You have to have excitations above that gap which go to zero in the thermodynamic limit. And that's not correctly described by this model. So it can't be describing a transition to any phase. Well, no, but the torus is just the way the theorem holds. I mean, it doesn't... yeah, well, it's just true everywhere. I mean, it's true in any... Well, I mean, so the degeneracy is not true, but basically, you know, if you want to...
If you put that theory on the torus, it won't have energy.
Yeah.
You put the theory up top of the torus, it doesn't have energy.
This is a theorem, not a theorem, it's a belief.
Yeah, okay, so to the extent that it's a theorem is depends on, I don't know, I mean, I mean it's obviously true, I mean, I think. and David, frankly, this underlies all of exotic quantum physics. It's this one electron per unit cell.
One spin, one half particle per unit.
Yeah, and exactly, and this...
By electron, you don't mean the charge.
Yeah, but I mean, it physically is an electron sitting on that site.
Oh, okay, but you're not using the charge.
No, they're not moving, but they're flipping their spins around. Yeah. Yeah, it's a crucial. It could be spin 3/2. Spin 2, I think it would be useful to illustrate it. If we had spin, this was a spin 2 model. Okay, then basically, it's like having four spin 1/2, roughly speaking, and you could form singlets, you know, taking this spin 2 and taking, you know, dividing into four spin 1/2 and pairing into singlets with the four neighboring sites. And so when you have spin 2, in fact, when you have spin 2, this, you kind of a transition from an anti-ferromagnet to a quantum paramagnet, and the critical properties are described by this theory. Spin 1, they're not either. It's even integer spin is 2 and 4, 6. It depends on the lattice. Yeah. Well, that's the, I mean, this is the... This is
in other words, because normally the continuum, we don't care about the lattice.
I know, but see, that's one thing we've, you know, really been forced to realize is that the lattice is crucial. And in fact, the Berry's phases that are lurking around are going to all do with commensurability of the spin with the lattice, you know. Right, and you know, I mean, I think this was all understood, you know, quite a few years ago by Duncan in the terms of the one dimensional, and you know, I think it was appreciated that it was these subtleties are there in two dimensions for quite some time, but You know, and that's why, I mean, the kind of, you know, whether you're going to get into some exotic spin liquid phase, you know, very much depends on the lattice you're on. If you're on a different lattice, you wouldn't have a prayer of getting this. So that's, so all of these non-universal features are very important for us to, if we want to try to have models which get into interesting phases, we have to really, you know, but for this, well, yeah, Leon wants to react, I think.
I don't want to call them non-universal.
But in physical terms, it is the lattice. I mean, you have the lattice sites. It doesn't. It can be in the continuum with a periodic potential. I mean, that, you know, and that's really what it, when electrons in a crystal, there's not a lattice site. I mean, electrons prefer to sit, you know, on particular atoms, right? And don't like sitting between. And you know, and so the results. I mean, we put it on a lattice just, you know, to make it simpler. It's not really the lattice that's important. It's the commensurability of the electron spin with the unit cell, the real space unit cell of the potential that the electrons are moving in. I guess that's.
So one can write something with a continuum version of this by incorporating what you just said. But the concept of commensurability, I don't know how to translate that.
Well, exactly. So that's what we've managed to do. I mean, is write down a continuum field theory.
Very different from Wilson's.
Yeah, so we've got a continuum field theory that can describe this transition directly, including that those commensurability effects, which play an absolutely critical role. I mean, that's. The same goes, by the way, for the valence bond solid. If you're trying to approach, you know, a magnetically ordered state coming from the valence bond solid, when R prime is negative, you're in the valence bond solid phase. When R prime is positive, you're in a state with a unique ground state, which is featureless and translationally invariant, you know, rather than being in the antiferromagnet. So, you know, you've clearly got a problem here.
Do you have an argument why they couldn't just coexist, the two other
grounds? No. In fact, I have an argument that they should coexist, which is Landau's argument, but it's wrong in this case, and that's really the moral of the whole talk, right? So let me give you that argument. So clearly something's going wrong. Well, okay, we have two order parameters. I assume Landau would tell us if you have two order parameters, you need a theory which has both sets of fields in it. And in general, there can be terms, you know, coupling terms. Coupling terms, though, are basically completely innocuous because these, you know, each field transforms under its own symmetry. I mean, this transforms like a vector under spin rotations, and this transforms under spatial rotations, transforms non-trivially. And so you can't write down, you know, weird things like, you know, psi times phi. It's just not allowed. And so, in fact, all the terms you can write down are so innocuous, you basically can just ignore them, and you can say, well, let me just, you know, forget fluctuations altogether, just do Landau theory. I mean, you know, just minimize the free energy, or minimize the Lagrange, and do a saddle point, I guess. And you have two possibilities. So let me say, you know, G is this effective coupling. This is some parameter in the model you're varying, and the two possibilities very quickly are, one looks like this, you know, zero and positive, where R is increasing this way. And so over here, you're in the antiferromagnet, because R is negative. Over here, R prime is negative, you're in the valence bond solid. Okay, and if this actually occurred, in between, you would be in the some quantum paramagnet. But clearly, there's a problem. So this actually, you know, this Landau theory doesn't offer a correct description for the physics. If you actually had a split transition, right? Because the phase in here is going to be non-trivial and with topological order or something like that. But the second possibility, which Landau theory does work for, is this. Oops. Ah. It's coexistence, right? So this is R, this is R prime. And so when R is negative, well, okay, this is AF, this is VBS. And in this region, of coupling constants, both R and R prime are negative, so they'll both be ordered. So it's anti-Fermionic order coexisting with valence bond solid order. Okay, and the phase transitions here and here would be correctly described by these field theories.
But could you use an entity that was more complicated than either of them?
Yeah, so, and that's what we've done. I mean, well, okay, so this is what I would say. We could try to do Su Shang Zhang, you know, phi, real psi, imaginary psi, SO5 maybe? Is that more or less? I'm not quite what he was doing. I mean, these are superconducting fields, but I mean, why not SO5 for this? Well, it just doesn't work. It's wrong. They can coexist when both R and R prime are negative.
Sorry, they're both
negative. Yeah, both R and R prime are negative. That's how they coexist. I mean, it's, yeah. You can always get a first order transition. I mean, that's not what Landau theory predicts.
I mean, Landau theory can't predict a first order transition.
What? It can, but actually in these cases it wouldn't. I mean, but right?
Depends on the
side.
Depends on the sign of lambda.
Oh, actually, it depends on the sign of lambda. Thank you. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, you're right. Well, so, I guess that's probably right, isn't it?
Landau theory scenarios can happen, and we understand them. The question is, one in principle, whether this non-Landau theory scenario can happen.
Matthew?
Yeah?
In your microscopic theory, you have, you know, J and J Fox,
yeah,
and J prime, yeah, whatever. And you imagine that as you vary these microscopic parameters, you wander on in this
hour. Yeah, you're moving R and R prime around. Yeah.
But you also at the same time moving U and U prime around.
Yeah.
Now, how do you know? Is there some hidden assumption saying that it's just a simple trajectory?
No, I mean, you know, there isn't, because in order to, I mean, but you're, in some sense you're asking me,
right,
to solve the models, to know which phase I'm in. Right. And, okay, that's non-trivial because it's a very complicated model.
I'm not asking you to solve the model, but how do you know?
Well, no, U and U prime can vary around too. But they better be positive, otherwise these field theories become, you know, otherwise the transitions, each separate transition is going to become first order.
Tony, are you asking them why, how I know that it doesn't happen?
Right, like, because from
you. Oh, fine-tuned?
Past my zero at the same point.
Right.
It can.
It could happen for a,
yeah,
fine-tuned model.
But you have to tune two parameters, and so you generically would not find phase transitions like that. Right? I mean, unless you could tune temperature or, I mean, particularly the quantum phase transitions, it's hard enough to tune one parameter, let alone two.
You have different scenarios,
yeah,
variables,
yeah,
but not that this couldn't occur.
No. Well, the bottom one can occur. Yeah. The top one cannot occur for this model, with this being a featureless quantum paramagnet. But, so we have a scenario where this can occur, continuous phase transition directly. Right? What's that?
I see how a valence bond
solid. Why not? Well, any two phases can coexist. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, in terms of you have alternating energies in the same valence bond.
It's perfectly fine. Duncan, it may be hard to write down a model which does it. I think that's what you're saying, in effect. You know, because if you have tightly bonded singlets, you know, where's the spin? And but no, but Landau has.
No, what are the wave functions of Duncan?
You know, Landau basically, if Landau, well, anyway, it's not.
Anyway, that's not the point.
That's not the point, yeah. What's that?
Bond ordering and cycle of
spins in each of these.
It can't be impossible. I don't believe it. What's that? Is it impossible? No, just...
You're imagining that you're in a stream, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Have weak bond combinations.
very, very weak bond alternation, a very weak local moment. Okay, so let me at least get to the third point before, I think we should excuse people and then, maybe if people want to stay, they can, but I think, so what's going wrong? Well, in fact, what's quite remarkable is the hints were already there in the early 1970s. So in fact, let's look at this theory, the 5-4 field theory, right? So, and try to approach, try to analyze the, fluctuations around this critical point in three dimensions. Okay, we can do a 4 minus epsilon expansion, and we find a fixed point. Okay, Wilson-Fisher fixed point, I guess. Okay, that's fine. It's not relevant to the problem we have here, but it's relevant, like, say, to the spin 2 model on the square lattice. But now rather than doing that, let's work with a vector with a fixed length. And rather than trying to approach the transition, essentially from the disordered side, which is what one, roughly speaking, doing in these soft spin field theories, although you can actually, calculate both sides. Let's try to approach the transition coming from the nail ordered side. Okay, so we write down a nonlinear signal model, right, which with 1 over g, d mu, I'm going to let d mu be space-time. I think that's okay, isn't it? There, with a constraint, n squared equals 1, right? And this was done in, who did this, by the way, in 1973? Was it Brezan? What's that? Who did the 2 plus epsilon expansion? Okay, so what we do here is, I want to draw a sphere, which I can't really draw, which is the, where the this n vector, lives on the sphere. Okay, and what I want to do is, I'm just remind you of what was done 30 years ago. You say I'm going to do a small expansion. I'm going to choose a direction in spin space along the z-axis, for example, because I want to expand around the ordered phase, and then I'm going to assume that sigma is a field which is in some sense small, and I basically take this and I plug it into nonlinear signal model, and I expand it out, and I get that the action of the nonlinear signal model is 1 over g d, I'll write it as dd x, space-time, 3, capital D is 3, d mu sigma squared plus order, I believe it's sigma to the fourth. Okay. But now we basically no longer have the constraint. We've solved for the constraint, so this sigma x and sigma y fields are unconstrained. And so we can just, try to do perturbation theory in the nonlinearity to try to approach the transition. And we can do a normalization group. I may be boring most of you, but let me just do it, actually, because I think it's quite remarkable the conclusion we're going to tentatively arrive at. The important point here is that, that because of the constraint ultimately on the nail vector to be 1, you don't want to rescale the field, okay? But you want to rescale here. B is some number greater than 1, and you can then write down normalization group flow equations dg d log b. Well, the first term is just literally from power counting, this d minus 2 derivatives there. And so this is, actually, it's 2 minus d, g. And then you have to do a one-loop calculation, basically, I think it is. So it looks like one loop. A constant times g squared plus order g cubed. This term is coming from the interactions between the spin waves. I mean, one has basically these small fluctuations around here described by sigma x and sigma y. And those, because of those two directions, then it's a nonlinear theory. and they interact. If this was just a O2, you know, in fact, if it was O2, what would we find? I guess we find that this constant vanishes. Yeah, when n is 2, so, but n is 3 here. So, okay, so this thing is a beta function, normalization group, beta function versus g, you know, minus, if I, okay, let me write, coming from the lower critical dimension, epsilon is 2 minus d. This is the beta function. I have an unstable fixed point at gc, and I flow at low temperatures, if you will, small g to the antiferromagnetic fixed point. I flow off to, you know, presumably the quantum paramagnet, which I've already, you know, which is what I was expecting. I flow off into this phase, and then I have a critical point with gc of order epsilon. So everything looks nice and controlled. Okay, now I'm going to say something which my collaborators may not like, but I'm going to say it anyway. Well, the first part they will not mind me saying, which is that ever since the 1970s, the general wisdom in the field has been that the fixed points that one's studying in the 4 minus epsilon expansion and in the 2 plus epsilon expansion are the same fixed point if you could, you know, extrapolate up to epsilon equals 1 to get into 3 space-time dimensions. Okay, what I actually think, I mean, to the extent that you can make sense of, you know, fractional dimensions, I think when we really realize now that, in fact, that's not true, and that the... Yeah, even for classical transitions, that the 2 plus epsilon expansion fixed point... For the O3 model...
Different model.
Yeah, but the fixed points, if you can extrapolate to 3 dimensions, I mean, I think essentially we believe they're going to be different. Well, is that reasonable to say, Leon?
Yeah,
you agree with that? Yeah. Well, the universal critical properties of the phase transition are different.
Yeah, of course, this has been known for a long time for the ON
model. Oh, okay.
Because the affinity, of course, is solid in both cases.
And no.
There's no.
At ON, at large N, they're not different, are they? I mean, I don't think. No, I don't think so.
ON,
well, maybe we don't.
Has a infrared fixed point under control someplace.
Yeah.
But doesn't have the Gaussian. Trivial fixed point that the four-dimensional...
No, but I mean something more than that we can't find the other fixed point in the theory. I'm saying these, the universal critical properties of these two phase transitions when you put epsilon equals 1 are different.
Is the problem of the epsilon expansion? Or is it the
problem? Well, it's a problem of ignoring topology. So that's, it's a problem of the fact that, let me draw it again. You don't see topology with small fluctuations. Well, because you certainly do, okay, so the topological defects that you're not seeing, that you're blind to in the 2 plus epsilon expansion, are rampant in the soft spin 5 to the 4th field. What's that? I don't know, just because it's simplicity, you know, I don't know.
But it seems that the belief is not that widespread.
Yeah, but I'm not sure you understand. I mean, would you think that if I could, you know, calculate to, you know, very high orders in epsilon in the 2 and then put, you know, extrapolate with Borel's summability and so forth, that I would actually end up with the same exponents? Well, okay, if it happens, I think it's, you know, maybe an accident. The 2 plus epsilon is not that well behaved, I mean, I think at high orders, but... Okay, but, well...
So which is the correct theory for epsilon equals 1?
It depends on the physics, right? So so for the spin 2 antiferromagnet, on a square lattice going from the AF to a featureless quantum paramagnet, this is the correct theory. We believe for spin a half, going from the antiferromagnet to the valence bond solid, this is the correct theory. Yeah, you do. Yeah. But the Berry's phases are sensitive to the global topology, and well, I mean, you probably don't even have to in some sense. Yeah, you don't have to. Yeah, you don't have to add them.
There's a question about the critical exponents.
Yeah.
The nonlinear signal model that leads to for any n, the O n nonlinear signal model.
Yeah.
And the O n
soft spin. I mean, five fourths here, there.
Going down from four to up from two.
Yeah.
Don't agree. I think that's. There is a lot of evidence
that they do it. Well, that evidence, I mean, I think there are different fixed points.
It's not the same as what you're saying.
It is, I think.
Yeah, both of those are continual models. There's no that I don't think.
No, I know, but I stand by the statement that they're describing different fixed points in three dimensions. So let me just tell you very quickly some numerical calculations. And this is really the very important work of Lasek and Ashwin. Which is basically the nonlinear signal model, but I mean this calculation has ignored, it's insensitive to topological defects. So let me just discuss the topological defects, okay? So the topological defect in coming out of the antiferromagnetic phase in the O3 d equals 3, you know, space-time dimensions is a hedgehog. Which, okay, in space-time, you know, x, y, time looks like it's an instanton event because it occurs just at one time, and I can't really draw it, but you know what a hedgehog looks like. It's coming out in all directions, okay? I mean, it'll be coming out here in the front and the back in maybe I'll jump to the numerics. So what Ashwin and Lasek, and I assume Lasek actually did the numerics, but is that true, Ashwin? they did.
Both branches are not determinative. This is not the best.
Okay, let me tell you the result. The Zimmer-Holm is fractional dimensions a bit ill-defined, so let me consider two models in d equals 3, cubic lattice, you know, O3 vectors living on the sites of the cubic lattice with a nearest neighbor interaction. And we can do, you know, one could do two things. One can just simulate the model as it stands, and one has the antiferromagnet and the paramagnet. I'll call it quantum. This parameter G. What one could do here, what they did is to suppress completely. Well, it's suppressed at long length scales, hedgehogs. You know, so they go into a little cube in the cubic lattice, and you can, you know, basically you say, I'm going to put a term into the you know, classical Hamiltonian, into the action on the lattice scale, which says that the, you know, a hedgehog on that space-time cube costs an infinite amount of energy. So you just forbid it. I mean, at least in spirit. What they did. And what they found, it's by no means obvious that you can in fact destroy the antiferromagnetic order if you suppress all these hedgehogs. But you can, and you go to a different quantum paramagnet, and this critical point, I mean this one is Wilson-Fisher, the 4 minus epsilon. Okay, let me just, we write in three dimensions where everything's well defined. This is a Wilson-Fisher fixed point. This one is the new deconfined fixed point. And I should say this quantum paramagnetic phase is dramatically different than the quantum paramagnetic phase if you don't suppress hedgehogs. I mean, there's basically a hidden topological order in this quantum paramagnet, because there are, you know, suppressed hedgehogs, and so in the quantum paramagnet, the conventional one, you know, all correlation functions fall off as exponentials, and so forth. I mean, everything is, and this other transition, there are certain correlation functions, S1 dot S2 cross S3, that are the same operator at zero. Correct me, guys, if I'm wrong. This is 1 over R cubed, I think, isn't it? I mean, this is in space-time. Yeah. In fact, this QPM star is described by the Coulomb phase. Yeah, Coulomb phase of a U1 non-compact gauge theory. And so there's a photon, and it's this photon which gives this parallel correlation.
Matthew, could I go back to Gunn's question? Would you answer rather glibly?
Oh, sorry.
I can understand that quantum Hall effect cannot be described by Lyman-Ginzburg, which is what you're trying to argue, that Lyman-Ginzburg, there are a lot of things that don't fit for Lyman-Ginzburg, what Randall has been saying. Now, but because in quantum Hall you cannot write down a local order parameter for Lyman-Ginzburg, but you are exhibiting example in the two phases, you have local order.
Yeah, so you can describe the phases correctly with Lyman-Ginzburg approach, I mean, yeah, just in terms of an order parameter.
Gunn's question was, why couldn't you, this doesn't mean Lyman-Ginzburg failed.
Well, no, it fails because it predicts.
It's one kind of order.
Well, okay. I mean, okay. Well, the question of how. I mean, ultimately we're going to use a field theory, right? But we're going to be working with fields which are different than the two order parameter fields. In fact, we're going to be working with, and I'll just. So we're going the other way around. So we're going to introduce, essentially, quark fields. We're going to introduce spin-on fields, and we're going to introduce and decompose the valence bond field into two fields. I mean, it's these deconfined fields which carry gauge charges, which give the natural variables to describe this critical point.
Can you describe both sides?
The theory will describe both sides of the critical point, but these fields, these spin-ons, will be confined in the valence bond solid phase. But in some sense, they're going to be, in loosely speaking, deconfined at the critical point. They're not going to be free. And likewise, I think I probably got this right. On the other side, in an antiferromagnet, these are going to be confined. Actually, probably not. Well, I'm not sure if that's quite right to say that because it's. But, in some crude sense, yeah. All right, well, I think I basically should quit, actually, and let people go.
I mean, and if you said, Matthew, was that in the case of the, you start with cubic lattice with the nonlinear sigmoid, which has its
sigmoid. Yeah.
And then
suppresses them by hand.
You suppress the instoms in the quantum monocon.
Yeah.
Which you could also do by adding that appropriate term to the act.
Well, but it has to have an infinite coefficient. I mean, actually, yeah. Oh, and that's effectively what they probably did.
You,
I mean,
you suppress instantons, and that changes the nature of the phase transition.
And the nature of the disordered phase as well.
It's a disordered phase coming from.
I mean, what wasn't obvious to me was at all was that you could actually. You could actually destroy the order with just the spin waves alone without including hedgehogs.
Sure.
It wasn't obvious to me that, okay, this second calculation, you're suppressing the hedgehogs, and it wasn't obvious to me the second that you could necessarily destroy the long-range antiferromagnetic order, if you didn't allow hedgehogs. I mean, let me give you an example. It's like the, with Kossuth's thallus or something like that, you need the vortices to proliferate.
But here, in fact, you don't. Things are disordering.
Here you don't because the spin waves interact with one another.
Yeah, the perturbative calculation suggested already a phase transition without the instant.
Yeah, exactly.
Which themselves are highly disordering as well. QCD, we have a lot of debate.
Yeah.
Some of us for years tried to combine it, which comes out of both phenomena.
Yeah.
In the same direction.
Yeah.
So
But what's really fascinating here is you're saying if you remove one, so you have two things, both of which are disordered, the spin riding.
And the hedgehogs plus spin waves together, yeah.
And the instantons, which are always disordered.
Yeah.
And the spin waves could be, in some cases, disordered. You haven't asked about your free theory. I mean, four dimensions, they're ordered.
And you can certainly, I mean, you...
But the instantons are always disordered.
Yeah, essentially.
In case where they're both working together, you remove one, you still get disordering, but to a new thing.
Yeah, when you remove the hedgehogs or the instantons,
so yeah. Getting back to this issue, suppose you write an action. Suppose you write an action with this infinite coefficient term.
Well, that's what, I mean...
Can that be shown to be relevant? In which case
no, but I mean, it's numerics. It's not really soluble. I mean...
You have left off the connection to the... back to the original spin 1/2 model, which obviously doesn't have an infinite coefficient.
Yeah, no, okay, so so let me comment on that. So, you know, Lasik and Ashwin suppress these hedgehogs by hand, but they had to put a coupling which is infinite. It would say it has an infinite amount of action. Because any Polyakov has this argument that these instantons always proliferate, at least in the pure gauge theory, without matter fields.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Well, in presence of critical matter fields, that's not true, necessarily, particularly when you have Berry phase terms. These Berry phase terms, this basically the psi to the fourth plus psi star to the fourth. This field psi, this is the amazing thing. I mean, this has been known for some time, but I mean, it, by Subir Sashtev and Nick Reed. But this, the VBS order parameter can be correctly viewed as... when it acts on a state, quantum state, as putting in an instanton. And so you can view it as a skirmion creation operator.
Why?
Well, okay, that's... I could try to... I would have to be more involved, and that's what I was going to be doing, but I... You know,
but it's not an answer.
I mean, it's basically... Okay, ultimate... I mean, it comes... You Polyakov, I mean, you can... You know, you could start with the compact U1... You know, three space time dimensions, and he did a duality transformation to a monopole gas and the sine, you know, sort of a Sine-Gordon type theory. The Sine-Gordon theory has a field chi, and is related to Beyond-Spahn order. Now, in order to see, well, okay, in that dual representation, one can see that when one condenses the skirmions, that you get Beyond-Spahn order. And I'm not, is there a physical way to see this or not?
Basically, I understand consensually with my 68 from the
day. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Basically, what happens is the skirmion spin a half carries
momentum, essentially.
Momentum,
yeah.
Zero pi.
Yeah.
So if you can, the instantons are coming between different skirmion configurations.
Yeah.
And so if you spin a half comes between. Configuration is
yeah, and it can only happen in groups of four, as you.
If the skirmion creation became gapless, you would indeed pull down the extra zero energy modes. You've got zero energy modes and zero and pi and zero energy modes. If the gap for skirmion creation goes to zero,
yeah,
then you would also get zero modes at zero pi and pi.
Yeah.
Pi.
Yeah. Yeah.
The question is whether you can have the kind of.
But let me just say those two low energy or four low energy modes, you could ask, do they critically sort of behave independently, or do you have processes which transfer, you know, four of these into four of these? I mean,
the configuration with a skirmion in it has critical momentum zero pile.
Yeah.
To
sure.
But
that's with, so you can't by itself, but you could destroy four skirmions.
Right, but you'd have configurations with odd numbers of skirmions cannot quantum.
No, they can't.
Even numbers of skirmions to spin a half.
Even can't even do it in three, but four can together.
Yeah.
Four skirmions can come along and annihilate one another. Okay, but that's an irrelevant effect at the critical point. So at this critical point. You know, it's hard for four skirmions to come together and, you know, find each other. And so it's an operator with a high scaling dimension. And it's sufficiently high that it's irrelevant at the critical point. But it's what we call a dangerous irrelevant perturbation because in the valence bond solid phase, I mean, it's even the single skirmion is condensing. I mean, I guess momentum
has to be that term relevant because you have another gap.
Exactly. Well, in the valence bond solid, you have to condense a particle you break in translational symmetry, so you have to condense fields that carry momentum, right? And that's why when you condense your skirmions, which carry non-zero momentum.
So a system with a system in which the skirmions are condensed but with not valence bond order.
It doesn't exist. It's not possible.
It would have a gapless mode at zero.
Yeah, okay. It's not possible because
the systems up there you get the valence bond.
No, so that phase would be this, I think. I mean, if you actually tried to condense skirmions, but
if you're on the phase without neo order in between
I think that's this phase. That's what I think you're thinking of. But it doesn't exist because the action, because once you gap out the spin-ons, the matter fields, Polyakov's argument kicks in, and the action for having even a single hedgehog, a single skirmion vanishing, costs a finite amount of action, so they will proliferate. And you might say, how is that possible because they carry momentum, but then they break translational symmetry and give you the valence bond solid. Right. So it's not possible. That is the... It's only at the critical point...
The valence bond solid has Brown states of 0, 0 is a broken symmetry state.
Yeah,
Brown
I know.
0, 0, pi, 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 0, and 0, pi. The Miel state has low energy excitations only at 0, 0, and pi, pi. So if you can have a continuous transition between the two, which is this what you're proposing, you have to have the modes at 0, pi, and pi, 0 have to become gapless.
Yeah, no, all the modes are gapless.
Sure.
Yeah.
I imagine it's probably not obvious to anybody but Duncan and Matt that the skirmion should carry momentum. That's a really strange thing. It's just some texture in this spin configuration. And if we were thinking of a classical O3 model, it would be completely non-obvious. It's due entirely to these pretty subtle various phase effects that require very careful consideration. Something didn't work out 15 years ago.
Yeah, no, so that, you know, played a crucial role in, well, yeah, I mean, we're very much aware of that, and that feeds into this.
Is perhaps it's better thought about not in terms of what the low energy excitations are, but just the quantum numbers of the skirmion itself, or the skirmion creation operator. That operator psi, defined as something that creates a skirmion or inserts a monopole, has exactly the same transformation properties under all physical space group symmetries.
Under like 90 degree, like 90.
That Matthew defines in terms of these bond expectations.
The skirmion, or in the O3 signal model.
No, it doesn't. And that's the Berry's phases do this. So this, under a 90 degree rotation, it goes to, I mean, it picks up an I. For example.
The point is that the nail field is really related to some staggered.
Okay, so is there just a question of what's a generator?
The underlying quantum.
Which generator you identify with spatial rotation?
Yeah, it's dictated by the spin model that you start with, but I mean you have to, yeah. Well, in terms of the gauge field, you have a background charge. I mean, I think that's maybe.
Can you say anything about the two lengths you have to do
for? Not unless. I mean, I think we should finish, and then maybe I can, if people want to hang around. Yeah, no, exactly. And myself, too.